OTB's Mount Rushmore. 32 counties, one county representative choosing their sporting Mount Rushmore. Some decisions are easy.
And I was seeing teachers who had never expressed any emotion whatsoever lose their mind when Sonny was running in that home straight, trying to catch that bald spot.
Others are controversial.
Mayo's greatest celebrity fan now helps him earn his place on Mayo's Mount Rushmore is Kevin Kilbane.
Join the debate across all our social channels at Off the Ball.
George O'Connor, 17 summers in purple and gold.
And catch the live decision-making over the next few months on OTB AM, live every weekday at 7.30 a.m. on OTB Sports Radio.
The OTB Podcast Network.
Now then, you're welcome back to another edition of Golf Weekly. If you're listening to the pod on a Thursday, it is great to have you true devotees with us. We are on YouTube as well. And Sunday afternoon on Off the Ball. Up for discussion this afternoon, Tiger, Phil, the rivalry as they have the match part two this weekend. And we'll certainly have a glance back at Seminole as well, the first live televised golf since pandemic took hold. We have Nathan Murphy. Hello.
How are you?
Very well. Fionn Davenport is in Manchester. Hello to you.
Hey, Joe.
And Peter Lowry from the Spawell Driving Range. Week one, open for business. Hiya, Peter.
Hey, Joe. How are you?
Very well. How did
ding? Is this the first time since you won the Spanish Open that you've made more money out of golf than any other European Tour golfer?
No. Thanks. I'll say nothing to that. No, Nathan, nothing to that at all. But yeah, delighted to be back. Everybody's coming in the door. Can't believe you're open. I've never answered so many phone calls in all my life. So it's been great.
How is it working?
Look,
have you had to change much?
Yeah, we had to kind of change the structure of the shop, people walking in and out. Baskets are there for everybody. They've been, they sit in a kind of a bath of disinfectant to make sure that, you know, the handles are disinfected before people pick them up. We've opened grass bays on both sides of the range. We have a lot of social distancing measures, so. Yeah, look, it's been hard work trying to get it organized, but so far so good.
Can you be in a bay next to somebody else, or do you have to go every second bay?
No, we have 5 meters between where you tee it up and where the next person tees it up. So we've got plenty of room there for kind of social distancing.
Okay. And so the experience for the average customer hasn't changed all that much, I would suspect.
Not really, no. It's more a case of... what they experience when they come in is we've had to build plastic mat, you know, to just for the social distancing aspect of it. So that's kind of more in your face. And then they don't have a token to put into the machine. They literally just pick up their basket. But in general, everything is pretty much the same. There's no touch element of it. The doors are all held open. And there's plenty of hand sanitizer around the place. So in general, look, the weather's been great. So with the doors wide open, it's just nice. But in general, everything is pretty much the same.
Great. Must be a huge relief for you to get your business open and get some cash flow again.
It's huge. You know, kept the staff on. I didn't believe in. I had a couple of good lads working for me. So we made sure they were looked after. So it's great to be back and as you say, get a little bit of money into the till. And it's never mind that, it's just great to see people coming in again. You know, you have this facility and it's lovely to see, you know, the same faces that you'd missed and see how they were. And, you know, the driving range is a bit like a pub, really, you know, when you're standing there. It's, you know, the same guys are coming in, same ladies. You know, how are you getting on? Or how are you playing? And then they go out and hit the balls and then they come back in, have a little discussion about how they hit them. And off they go. And it's a very friendly atmosphere. So, you miss that. Like yourselves, guys, you know, you go in and out of the office and you missed a little bit of a banter that goes on in the office rather than, you know, being stuck at home. So there's lots to be missed. You know, this Zooming non-face-to-face, you know, it hurts kind of our social aspect of things. And we really need to get back to that.
There are advantages to working from home. My wife just arrived in with a prawn cocktail, not realizing I was on air.
Oh, glorious. Isn't she a lovely lady?
Now I need to weigh up do I just leave it for the next 45 minutes or do I sneakily, you know, grab a bite here and there?
Well, at least mute if you do, will you?
Yeah, I certainly will. Do you, and this is, haven't been out and about, listen, the last couple of days were probably exceptional because it was so warm in Ireland and how many people were out and about. Like, do you need to police the social distancing side of it?
It's amazing. You put up all these signs, Nathan, and you know, with your circular stand here and come this way. But people walk into the place and they are just so happy that we're open. They don't even pay attention to any signage. They just want to get their bucket of balls and go hit them. But you're right. We do have to police this. You know, you have to ask a few people the odd time is, you know, can you just stand there and hold on a second and, you know, you'll get served now in a sec. But, you know, we're all used to it now. You know, we all go to our shopping centres, our shops, Tesco's, Dunn's, Super Value, whatever it may be, and we all have to do our social distancing there to get in the door. But once you're in the door, people kind of forget. I don't know whether other people have, you know, you could be looking in the aisle and somebody kind of leans over to you and grabs milk from, you know, when you're looking at which milk to buy. People are different, you know, so you just have to get on with it.
Meanwhile, golf is open in Ireland, at least if you're within 5 kilometres of your golf course. And based on some of the photos I have been receiving from different people, the 5K limit must be the least observed of all the measures across the COVID-19 situation. I think, well, I'm not going to name names, clearly. But
there's been a few great stories out there. One in particular, and I won't name the golf course, but one of the members is a police officer. And he lives outside the 5K. So he decided that he would man the gate of the golf course. And a lot of people were kind of turned away recently once they were outside the 5K. And then a couple of other golf courses were kind of out in the – they're out of the way, let's put it that way, and they've been packed. And I think I know the police were into one down the country. So another golf course in Dublin, I believe, a very prominent one. A member got a phone call to say, why is your name on the sheet? And he said, I'm a member. I'm going to go play golf. And he said, excuse me, sir, you live outside of the 5K. So you have to, you know, abide by the rules and take your name off the sheet.
Yeah, I've heard of courses that have sent emails out to all their members who lived outside, obviously have all the addresses, and did their little bit of research and sent it out saying, listen, you got to wait a couple of weeks, unfortunately. I'm surprised that there haven't been more cases of the guards rocking up at the entrances to golf clubs. Look, it's not that big a deal, but it is, again, it is this societal issue that we're all going to face of, well, if he's doing it, well, why can't I do it? And that frustration that people are going to struggle, I think, to keep within them as we go on over the next few months, that, oh, well, these guys are just breaking and doing whatever the hell they want, yet I'm been an idiot here, staying inside on the hottest day of the year when I could have just driven 15 kilometers down the road and played a nice round of golf.
A lot of people are looking at, you know, if I get in my car at the house and I drive 5 kilometers, well, what's the difference between driving 5 kilometers and 10 kilometers or 15 kilometers? And to go play golf. So that's kind of their point. And there's been a lot in the range giving out about that kind of thing. You know, what is the difference? But look, I'm happy to have them as customers rather than going to the golf course.
Oh, I'd say you are. Peter Lawrie advocates we keep the 5K rule.
Forever.
So, gents, a few things to discuss. Let's glance back before we look ahead to Tiger versus Phil at the weekend. Seminole in Florida, this prestigious, well-known golf course for years, hosting the Walker Cup next year was the venue. This was Rory McIlroy and Dustin Johnson against Matthew Wolff and Ricky Fowler, with interviews in the midst of it all from Bill Murray and Donald Trump. It was all it was much criticized. I mean, the starting point, if we jump off on this point, Fionn, the starting point is $5 million raised for charity. No harm done to anybody. Lots of good done. That has to be the context. $5 million raised.
Absolutely. And, you know, they set out to do exactly what they had intended. And so even, you know, the defenders, and I noticed this on Twitter, there was kind of a split, if you can judge anything by Twitter. But there was people go, oh, geez, this is so awful, this is so bad. Or, and then there was the, look, it's the first game of golf of the year. Everybody just relax. Just enjoy what it is. Just watch live golf and be there. And as you say, you know, they raised all this money. The only thing that kind of afterwards really stuck with me is that did they do exactly what they set out to do? And that is appeal to that niche American golf market, which is, to put it slightly crudely, is rich white guys. And having Trump on was interesting. I mean, it's fine. You're going to have the U.S. president on because the U.S. president is not just a huge golf fan and a golfer, but owner of golf courses and is resident not that far from Seminole, because Seminole is in West Palm Beach, I think. But it's anyway, it's in that Jupiter kind of West Palm Beach area.
Yeah.
But, and what I thought was interesting was that Mike Tillico, who interviewed him, tried to hit him he was on the McKellar podcast. Rory was on the McKellar podcast, and, you know, he said some things, and then he kind of backed off he backed off asking him exactly what did you think of Rory's comments. And Trump kind of batted it away by saying, look, a lot of golfers like my politics, some don't. It's okay. I'm fine. You know, it's okay. And then at the very end of the interview, I'm sure you all notice, is that just as Mike Tillico was signing off, Trump goes, oh, and by the way, I haven't forgotten when we played. I really enjoyed that game that you and I played together. And so in a sense, this is the market. This is it kind of leaves a lot of international viewers a little cold, I thought, that little bit.
Well, on that, interestingly, to round off the Trump discussion, so Mike Tirico, he signs off by saying, I got to see, you know, firsthand, you know, you're a good player, you're a good putter, knock it to kick in distance often. I thought that was a strange comment, weird way to sign off. But anyway, then it turns out Rick Riley's book, Commander and Cheat, How Golf Explains Trump, which is all about Trump's cheating, of their match together. So reading here from the New Yorker extract, Trump doesn't only give himself unfair advantages, he has also been known to hobble his opponents. On another occasion, recounted by Riley, Trump was playing with Mike Tirico, the sportscaster. He hit a long, soaring second shot into a par five. He high-fived his caddy and he headed for the green. When he got there was no sign of his ball. It had somehow ended up in a sand trap some 50 feet from the pin. Lousy break, Trump said. Tirico was so befuddled that he took a seven. Afterwards, Trump's caddy told Tirico that his approach shot had actually finished up 10 feet from the hole. He told him, Trump threw it in the bunker. I watched him do it. So when Tirico said the whole knock it to kick in distance often line, he was having a massive dig at Trump, and Trump was like, okay, bye, bye, bye.
So who does that remind you of? That exact example. Is it the man with the golden gun? The Bond movie where James Bond plays golf with Donald Pleasance, and Donald Pleasance's caddy is, you know, the guy, the big heavy set Samoan guy with the bowler hat.
Yeah.
And that, like, and the caddy is just cheating for Donald Pleasance all over the place. And
odd job.
Anyway, odd job. That's the one. Yeah. So odd job is doing all kind of dropping balls out of his pocket. But it's like, that's exactly the kind of stuff that is. Yeah.
I mean, okay. So Mike Tirico, props to him for, again, that little dig in at Trump in a way Trump didn't even notice. He was getting a huge amount of criticism for not taking Trump to task over Rory's comments. I think under the circumstances, it would have been inappropriate. It was an unenviable position. Maybe the best approach would be not to get Trump on in the first place. Could you imagine if Mike Tirico had said, well, we have you, and went to absolute town on Trump? It would have been fantastic, obviously, but it's expecting an awful lot of Mike Tirico to do that.
I think that's absolutely right. And I mean, Trump turned it into a bit of a partisan broadcast himself, but every time Trump opens his mouth, he's partisan, you know, because the intention, I'm assuming, was to have a golf-loving, golf-course-owning U.S. president on the line to say, hey, isn't it great that golf is back? It's good to see these guys. Nice to see Seminole, of course, I know well. And, you know, so long and good luck. Thank you very much, Mr. President. I hope you enjoy, you know, the rest of the round. But, and even the Bill Murray stuff was like, I mean, Bill Murray seemed like he couldn't wait to get away fast enough. And I'll tell you, overall, it's not my overall thought. And I take on board the fact that, like, look, this is paltry stuff. We don't have a lot to go on. One is that they could have left the mics open. I was much more interested in the, I don't mean like banter between the golfers and trash talk, which is all forced and rubbish anyway, but actual musings and observation that each four would make about, oh, you know, I thought that line, or as a golf nerd, because let's be honest, who else is going to watch this but golf nerds? That's the interesting stuff. And I felt that the commentators, Tirico, etc., were almost neurotically trying to fill the space with just chat. And it was like, I don't want to hear Mike Tirico. Just leave the mics open. Let the golfers chat amongst themselves. And in fairness to Rory, for the first few holes, I don't know if you noticed, but he seemed to be the one who, you know, put on, we got to get something out of the four of us. So he was doing some of the talking, and that little comment to Matthew Wolf, whatever Matthew Wolf threw some shade at him, and he goes, you know, hey, I've won two FedEx Cups. That's $25 million. That struck me as the most un-Rory-like thing. It was like he was like playing to camera or something.
Don't boast about the money you've made.
Yeah, it's just like, we all know you're worth, you know, you're richer than Midas. It's okay. But overall, you know, happy golf was back. You know, I thought Seminole, which I know is storied and legendary, and it's Donald Ross and 1930 and Ben Hogan, his favorite hole was the sixth. But it looked really drab on TV. It looked featureless. And I appreciate that playing a golf course is an entirely different experience to watching it on television. But purely as a television spectacle, I thought it looked very, it looked like a resort course that opened last year. It was so
Fionn, going forward with these golf tournaments that are going to be, there's going to be no grandstands. Like, I wouldn't recognize a tour golf course without grandstands. And that's what it's going to be for the next 3 weeks. When golf returns, we're not going to be able to recognize the golf courses. We'll all think they're plain and average golf courses because they're not. Each green is not surrounded by a grandstand. It's just wide open. Like, you'd hardly recognize the 18th in Augusta without all the galleries around it, or even the 16th. So
it's a great point.
It's going to be very difficult to watch golf. And I found it exceptionally difficult. To be honest with you, I turned it off. I was bored senseless.
I knew you were going to say that in advance. I have no doubt. The reason I didn't go to you first, I knew you didn't stick with it.
Yeah, no chance, no. And I was like watching paint dry. And I just thought, wow, these lads. Like, why don't they just...
Yeah, but the whole point, Peter, is we've been in lockdown for 2 months. We have watched, we've actually watched paint dry.
Yeah. I know, you will speak for yourselves. But look, it's just, as a, you know, I would say to Fionn about being golf perverts rather than...
golf nerds.
Golf nerd, but I call you golf pervert.
Why is it always golf perverts? Can we not just go with golf nerds? Like,
Is there something to be ashamed perverts of for better. Loving golf?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But look, I'm. You're right. The big thing was get as much money together as possible, and they, you know, they did it for the right cause. But in general, it suffered badly, I think, as a spectacle.
Now I will say there were three massive positives for me. Like, one, watching pro golfers carry their own bag, amazing. I thought that was sensational.
And struggle with
DJ.
What do I do?
Absolutely. Like, strapping on the thing. And, like, I loved, it was as close to us mere mortals, you know, taking out the laser sights, etc., to kind of gauge the distances, and obviously not having any caddies there.
Can I just touch on that for 1 second with the playoff at the end when Rory went up and said it's 121? Did anyone else think it was going to get really awkward and that some of the other players mightn't have believed him? And also, I was wondering, what if he's lying? Like, wouldn't it have been a masterstroke to go 121, but actually it was 131?
But here's the question.
That would have been funny.
But I've played, so let's say you're playing in your Saturday comp, and sometimes, like, I'll go in a distance, I'll just announce it's 148 to the flag. I never would dawn on me to lie, ever, in a million years.
Wow.
Nathan, I put a point to you Gary Murphy made during the week in the Mirror. It was an interesting one, because some people talk about, like, Fionn's there saying them, those guys carrying the bags and everything was fantastic. And actually, I think in Gary's piece, he said it, that took away the sense of stage from the whole thing, and they didn't like that. And Peter's point about the crowds is very interesting as well. But Gary Murphy was talking about the general flatness of it. He said in his piece in the Mirror, why are these stars famous? He says, because TV companies have made them famous. The reality is they are just normal people who happen to be very good at sport, but they are normal guys. That's why it all looks so staged, because the stage is the secret. How they are positioned and created by TV, that's the magic. So for him, it was a bit flat when you strip away the crowd and just mic them up and hope for a scintillating conversation. They're just normal guys.
They are, which again, I think, goes back to the production values, which we talked an awful lot about with Tiger and Phil first time round. So if you're setting up a reality TV show, you're looking for a certain type of personality, somebody who will stand out from the crowd, that if you're picking four golfers, you either need to do an awful lot of hard work with them behind the scenes to set this up, or pick the four most interesting people you possibly can. And even still, you need to get at them. Like, I think Rory, everything we saw was he made an effort. Yeah. But he ended up having to make too much of an effort.
Yeah.
But it got me thinking, if you had this weekend, instead of what we have with the two American footballers playing with Tiger and Phil, if you had put Rory and Brooks in with Tiger and Phil, it could have been sensational. Again, with the proper production and talking to Tiger and Rory in particular, who you feel would be the presenter of this, yeah, no matter what, or even Rory and Phil together. So I think, again, the production values just totally let it down. Watching the four people play a pointless four ball who don't really know each other that well is never going to be great unless they have something interesting to talk about. And I agree with all Peter's points. Anyone who's ever been, and the Open Championship's the only major I've ever covered, but every time you'll see, oh, this is what this place looked like 6 months ago. And it's totally unrecognizable. When you don't have both the natural amphitheater of spectators and the big 18th grandstand, even walking along on a Tuesday or Wednesday of a major, it feels big because everything is big. Mm. So I think it is going to be fascinating to see, from a number of reasons, which we touched on before, of like no crowds to stop players' balls from rolling out of bounds. Is that going to change things? To again not being able to hit up the back of the 18th right up to the grandstand and take your free drop there. Mm. So it was good. It was good to golf back in that I was sitting down and I missed the first sort of 45 minutes, and you feel like, well, maybe I'm missing something not watching this, which for 2 months you haven't had. But yeah, it was flat, and like aside from Rory, I didn't think there was much to it at all.
Yeah. I must say I like Matthew Wolff. I mean, only because he's got that such a crazy backswing. You know, I realize these are four TaylorMade athletes. The whole thing was sponsored by TaylorMade, so it was always going to be. But the idea of you have Ricky Fowler, who was perennially popular with golf audiences. You have DJ and Rory, who were two of the bigger stars in the game. Well, Rory the biggest. And then you have Matt Wolff, who at 21 is presumably a star of the future. But with this, like, I loved watching that swing. Like, and the fact that, like, it's not lost in a field of 150 players, but that you're watching him swing the club, whatever it is, like 70 times. And I loved watching that. I don't know why. Maybe I'm desperately looking in the weeds for good stuff. But like,
did you see the thing on social media with the their backswings at the top of their backswings?
Yeah, it's incredible.
That was, I think, the best thing to take out of the whole lot as a golf nerd, is how you can be so different at the top of a backswing and still produce the club back to the ball in an incredibly consistent way.
Yeah. Do you know what's amazing is Rory said on the McKellar podcast that he's talked to Matthew Wolff about his swing, and Wolff feels he's bringing the club straight back and straight through. If you were, you know, if he had to best explain what he's doing, he thinks he's just bringing it straight back straight through, which is the extraordinary thing. This is the TrackMan generation, isn't it? That's what's becoming very apparent. They have stopped worrying about positions and Ledbetter and how it looks. All they care about are the numbers, and they've had TrackMan for a huge proportion of their careers now. Rory's almost a throwback the way he's so conventional.
Yeah, TrackMan has changed the game. And I don't know whether you've been watching even Porik's tips on Twitter there. He's been talking about...
I've seen about 3,000 of them. I've missed the other 8,000.
Right, yeah. But some of them are exceptional. And even if you just listen to one or two of them, he's talking about the TrackMan, about spin of hitting a lob shot or hitting a pitch shot, that it has to come out a certain degree angle to create the appropriate spin. And these are all based on TrackMan, TrackMan, TrackMan the whole way through. And modern golf is now, as you said, it's all about numbers, spin rates, angle of attack, and you know, the descent of the golf ball when it hits the ground. And it's incredible that golf has changed so dramatically from it's such a feel sport to a number sport. And once you get the numbers right, then you're away. Mm. But again, it'll only work on nice weather, nice conditions. Once you start getting bad conditions, then TrackMan's out the window and it's back to old-fashioned way. Just get the ball out there.
Yeah. Just to finish up in 7-0, and we'll look ahead to Tiger Phil, it is worth just remarking on the fact that Rory did effectively call out the President of the United States, and then that was put to him on live television. Like, it was kind of a surreal moment that Donald Trump was on the phone and this was being put to him. I don't know, did you hear the McKellar podcast where he gave the interview? He didn't bring this up himself. He was asked about it by Lawrence Donegan, and he was almost queasy at looking to self-aggrandizing. And he said, it's very self-serving for me to say now, oh, I probably won't play with Trump again. But, you know, he gave a very good answer and talked about how Trump was making the thing into a bit of a context, and it's not how a leader should act, and it shouldn't be a campaign rally. And on balance, I probably wouldn't play with him again. But I did find him to be very charming and charismatic and nice when I did play with him. Like, he's got something about him. Thought he handled that very well. Like, it was a tricky spot to be put in, Fionn, and he got plenty of criticism initially with the Trump stuff. So thought kudos to him.
Yeah.
It's not easy when it's going to be in the New York Times and the Washington Post and Global News as soon as you say it.
It is. You're absolutely right. But it is remarkable to think that what is just a mild comment, really, in yeah. truth, about a president who defines himself as much as who he's for as who he's against. So he's very much an oppositional type politician. My point is that Trump never pretends to be the president for all Americans. He's the president for guys who, you know, who, and everyone else is kind of the enemy. But Rory's was really a mild comment that has been blown up into this thing. So yeah, so for Rory, as a non-national resident of the United States and one of the bigger names in golf, to say it was took some thought, I imagine. And I thought he was very, yeah, it was like, it's pretty reasonable, you know. Yeah. Maybe not, it was a pretty reasonable comment to make, you know. It's just that, like, I mean, we're a golf podcast, we're not going to get into it, but like, you know, you look at the state of affairs and it's like, well, it's not being handled particularly well. And but I wonder is Rory, does he have an eye on an international audience? I don't mean this in a cynical way, but he's also mindful of the fact that, like, you know, he has golf fans all over the world. And like, he's not just a Republican voting American golfer who, that's not his perspective, you know. Mm. He might reside there, but he is much more of a global figure. So, you know, it'll play very, very well with his international fans, and I think probably it'll play kind of mildly okay with yeah. everyone else in America.
Yeah. On Seminole, by the way, even Rory conceded that these four had the ability to completely overpower it. So apparently, you know, that is the issue with the course. He was saying on par fives, we're hitting our second shots in with 5 irons. He said, for my dad, who's yeah. a member, and for his mates, it's still a fantastic challenge. And it's Walker Cup venue next year. So it's the equipment. It's one of those courses, the equipment has just completely overpowered.
In 1949, Ben Hogan hit the driver 265 yards, which is the best he ever hit it. Right. And and that's a course, Donald Ross, 1930, that's a course for Ben Hogan. So a guy, not a guy like Matthew Wolff, who hit a 358-yard drive.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's Seminole. As a mate texted me and said he presumed we'd be glad to have this back so we could completely overanalyze it. And I think we've done that really well.
I think we have.
So Tiger versus Phil, Nathan, you're frothing at the mouth for this one.
Woo, wow. Add two more incredibly interesting characters in Tom Brady and, is it Peyton Manning or Eli Manning?
Peyton,
great.
You mean two Hall of Famers from America's most popular sport?
brilliant. I'm delighted, and I'm sure all of America will tune in. Are they going to be interesting? Are they going to say anything for the entire 18 holes?
Do you know the inherent problem with trash talk in an instance like this? There is no sweet spot. It is either way too soft and therefore lame, or actually it's a little bit mean and uncomfortable.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
And I wish it was all mean and uncomfortable.
That's what, get Peter Lorre, tag Peter Lorre in.
It would be interesting, yeah.
There's an element to Schrodinger's cat about it all, though. Is that
Now, hang on. There's a reference that nobody gets.
Okay, well, here's the thing. Schrodinger's cat is a thought experiment that where the act of observing something changes it.
Oh, yes, okay. I remember hearing about this when Big Brother came on the scene.
Yes, so the idea, it's a complicated thought experiment where
can we not just leave it at Big Brother? Is that not the, pitch in at that cultural level?
So trash talk, when it's done away from the glare of the cameras by players who have a history and a dynamic and a way of kind of motivating themselves and kind of needling each other, it has an organic feel to it. But once you turn the cameras and the microphones on, that's gone. It's over. It changes everything about it. So it goes to exactly what you said. You're either super conscious about not being mean, or you just come across as really kind of bit mean and a bit too nasty. And so it doesn't work. And it's staged, and it's like, and then I said, and you're like, oh, Jesus.
There was one a couple of years ago with Agassi and Sampras where they were mic'd up on the court. It's on YouTube. You can check it out. And it got progressively meaner. And then the whole thing turned uncomfortable. The crowd even were a bit like, ooh. And it is because, you can say whatever you want to somebody if it's trash talking and just the two of you. It's such a great point. But if there's an audience there, it does totally change it.
It completely changes it. And I have no doubt that Tiger, who, and Phil, who are clearly both hyper-competitive and certainly know how to represent themselves well on the tee box, like the fact that from whatever it was 2 years ago, it was just awful. And I have no reason to think that it would be any different.
I've one reason. Tiger Woods may just put on an exhibition of golf.
Which was
not an option 2 years ago.
You bet. Yeah. Does Tiger turn up in the green jacket on the first tee?
That would be funny.
What would be funny if they just ended up putting one green jacket on top of another green jacket on top of another and eventually Tiger wins.
Yeah.
It obviously this one's going to be behind closed doors again, is it?
Yeah.
Yes.
So it's just the four of them mic'd up and away they go.
Yeah.
I would like to hope that they learned something. Maybe they learned. I hope they learned something from last weekend because let the players kind of chat more and stop because they're muting the mics and turning them on and off. So just let them at it. And
brief a tangent, and then we might talk about the Phil Tiger rivalry. Peter, is there ever a time coming where we'll have the players mic'd up like this all the time, or certainly the groups in contention or the feature TV groups? Because, it looks to me like an absolute no-brainer.
I think we're going to have the caddies probably mic'd up in a way where the player and caddy conversation over the shot will be much clearer.
Great.
And I think then they'll be able to kind of break away from it. And then if the player hits a bad shot and there's cursing or whatever else there may be, it's not really that close. I think the caddies will probably be mic'd up beforehand than the players.
But surely you can just put a 5-second delay on everything.
Well, yeah.
I would assume now is the time to do it as well, because behind closed doors, there's going to be a lot more silence. There's no polite applause. There's none of that. So whenever the European Tour does return, or maybe even with the PGA Tour, now is the time to actually have a bit more of a hum in the background. It is trying to get the little nuggets, though, because there was, as Fionn touched on, some conversations. And this actually happened with Tiger and Phil last year, which I couldn't understand. That when they were actually talking to each other, half the time, that's when the commentators decided to come in over them.
Right.
Yeah, it's nearly a time just leave it, let them at it. You just have to be very careful of I think a lot of them would be very careful of what they say. They don't really want to let any cats out of the bag, but also they want to be try to be somewhat amusing. And that's very difficult. It's nearly impossible.
It is.
If you're very careful of what you have to say and what kind of stories you can tell, it's nearly impossible to be in any way interesting.
But to,
you know, I, on the other hand, just open my mouth and, you know, it just comes out. But
and you're just fascinating without even trying.
And then the brain kicks in and go, maybe I shouldn't have said that. But sure, look, it's out there anyway.
But not to repeat ourselves, because we've said this a few times at this stage, I think it's very difficult for the players impromptu to have those conversations. I think they could very easily, over a conference call in advance, pick 16 or 17 set-piece conversations, and they get to each tee box and they open a box and they find out what they have to discuss. So, for instance, imagine Phil and Tiger get to the second fairway, they open the box, and the topic for discussion is 2004 Brookline when we played together and lost both matches at the Ryder Cup. Let's discuss that.
That's a really good idea.
You know, and because Phil's on record as saying Hal Sutton screwed them by giving them 2 days' notice, and Phil played with a low spin ball, Tiger with a high spin ball, and it was just a mess. You remember Hal Sutton hit back. But equally, it might be the opportunity where they could say, we didn't like each other that much then either. You know, how was that for you? How was that for me? You know, we were two alpha males. Harrington said that recently, you know, because he played against them. You're two alpha males and you need someone to lead and someone to follow on a team for it to work really well. So that could be fascinating 5-6 minutes. Get to the third tee, pick something else. You know, I think it's a lot to expect. And McIlroy really tried, to his credit, at the weekend to get something going. He even said at one point, lads, we're being a bit quiet here. Come on, let's do something about it. It's a huge amount to expect them to decide, what are we talking about? And actually, what do I want to say, not say? It's so much easier to just walk in silence. But they could agree 15 topics in advance. Well, let's do that. They get to a certain tee, they find out what it is, and let's see what happens that way. I think expecting them to generate something, which we all really enjoy and seize upon, you know, and it doesn't always have to be controversy. It can be, what player did you learn the most from? And you know,
what's the toughest drive on tour?
All that stuff sparks
something.
Yeah.
And I think if it's the net there, Joe, I think that's a brilliant thing. You know, on the tee, you pick out ball, discuss X. No, I think it's a great idea.
Like you could package that into the whole experience where you could actually, they get to the tee and there's a little box and they open it up and pull out the question. Oh, and that would be, and that's part of the spectacle. Like we, the audience, are waiting to see what's written on that card.
And introduce a charity element, if you want, whereby you get to bid to ask the question, and suddenly there's this camera screen there, and Michael Jordan pops up, and he says, "I want you to talk about Hazeltine." You know, whatever. You could add a whole load of razzmatazz to the thing, but I don't know.
Do the players want it? That's the thing. So you get sense Rory wouldn't actually mind a little bit of honesty at times. But do Tiger and Phil really want...
I think Phil might. I'm not so sure.
I wonder. So again, on the sort of banter side of things that we've seen. Like you think back to how sort of notorious Phil's Tuesday games became. And as you say, like it, by all accounts, incredibly cutting. The sort of stuff you could only say in private. That... The alternative is this for sort of faux banter where how many times can we slag each other off? So I won this and you won this and it's really dull. Does Phil want to open himself up to having that conversation when it's easier to just sort of keep your head down? Yeah. Like they're turning up, they're playing golf, they're raising money. I'm sure they feel they're doing enough and maybe they are.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be great to ask Tiger rather than, you know, what club did you like the most or what golf club made you the most money? What golf club cost you the most money?
I knew he was going there.
We get it. We have to make sure the audience get it.
Trust me, the audience
get it. Have you seen the format for it? Is the idea is to try and get it a little bit exciting. So,
no.
So 9 holes are going to be 4 balls, so best ball. And then alternate shot play. For the back nine. So Peyton Manning hits a bad one and then all of a sudden Tiger's got to.
Interesting.
And one of the holes, the fifth hole, is going to be a one club challenge. So I don't know if they're just going to be given a club or they have to pick a club and play the entire hole with just that club. I'm going with a 4-iron.
How then do we remember the Woods-Mickelson rivalry? I mean, it's effectively finished. Obviously, Phil was a couple of years older than Tiger, and Lawrence Dunningham was on last night and said, you know, Tiger always had Phil in his sights as the slightly older kid in California. Phil had won 9 times when Tiger came on tour. By 2001, Woods had 5 majors to Phil's 0 majors. It was amazing it took Phil so long. 82 wins Tiger, 44 Phil. I mean, next after them is Vijay Singh on 34, Dustin Johnson 20, Ernie Els 19. So Phil's 44 wins are actually massively underappreciated, most likely. The obvious thing to say for a starting point is, and I know, Fionn, you've been looking into it a bit for various hot points or points of discussion. The two obvious points to make are Ryder Cup chemistry was so decidedly off. And secondly, they were never in a final pairing on a Sunday, back nine of a major going down the, you know, getting into it. That's the one thing.
No.
Over all the years, it's amazing we never had that once.
No. However, what I was surprised to discover is that there have been 9 occasions where Phil and Tiger, or Tiger and Phil, have finished 1-2 in a tournament. And do you want to hazard a guess as to what the overall record is between them in those 9 events?
Tiger 5-4 winner.
7-2.
Tiger?
Yes.
5-4 Phil.
Ooh.
Yeah. And now the key ones is that only one of those is a major and Tiger won it. So, I mean, as much at first, when I was looking into it, I was thinking, this is a bit similar to the big three of the 60s, which is manufactured by a PR firm just to kind of generate some interest. But I mean, you lay it out, you know, that Mickelson of current players, that Mickelson is the second winningest, if you can use that. But that he is not quite half, but, you know, to all intents and purposes, he's got half the number of victories and a third, less than a third, the number of majors. Because, as you said, like by the time, like Mickelson was the hot guy, won 9 times, then Tiger. But within, Tiger won twice in his first year. Set by the time, like, what was it? Phil didn't win his first major till 2004. Like, Tiger, it's streaked away. What there is there's it, like the rivalry as such. Now, I've always felt that ignoring the kind of the slights that Tiger had about Phil's body shape, and, you know, he made fun of him behind his back, and there was that time when Mickelson pointedly criticized Tiger's Nike clubs. Remember that?
Yeah.
When he goes, oh, he's playing with inferior equipment, and then tried to save it by saying, you know, only a player of his ability can play as well with inferior equipment. But Tiger's really annoyed that I can really push it out past him, you know? So it must have gotten, like, by the time 2004 came around, the only person it really seems to be getting to is Mickelson. Mickelson, who is still majorless, despite being on tour, whatever it is, 6 years more. So, you know, he's been on tour for 14 years and still hasn't won a major until 2004 when he won his first Masters. And Tiger is cleaning up everywhere. And as much as we Europeans, we like to think that if it wasn't for Tiger, Ernie Els would have won more than just 4 majors. The simple fact of the matter is, if it wasn't for Tiger, Phil would have won way more majors. Phil probably could have won 8-9 majors. I'm looking, so I have, like, I won't bore you with some of the 1-2s, but there's some very interesting ones. There's some, like, you could go on and on. In 2005, so that was really the beginning of what we can deem a proper rivalry between the two, because Mickelson had already won a Masters. Tiger won in 2005 with his great performance against Chris DeMarco. And you have Mickelson, who's putting the green jacket on Tiger. The following year, it's the other way around. Tiger is putting the green jacket on Phil. So that sense of a rivalry really comes into play then, in that little kind of golden moment. I'm just looking at all the list here. So you had some interesting showdowns between them away from the Masters. Like, for example, in the 2007 Deutsche Bank, you had Tiger Phil. They played for 3 of the 4 rounds, including the Sunday, and Mickelson beats Woods by a pair of strokes. And then Tiger responded by winning the FedEx Cup. And Mickelson making that comment, he goes, yeah, I won $1 million and Tiger wins 10. You know, so, like, there was these little kind of pointed remarks. However, that rivalry kind of ends in 2009 with Tiger's problems, and Mickelson just kind of, you know, Tiger becomes a non-force for a good number of years after 2009, and Mickelson just continues to win, etc. But one of the interesting things was, around that time, a softening in the relationship between them. So, for instance, you remember in 2009, Mickelson's wife Amy was diagnosed with cancer, and then Mickelson made public the exchange between the two that happened by text. And it kind of speaks to the nature of this rivalry, which is far more friendly than we think, but at the same time, still punctured with a little, and here, I'll read you the exchange. Tiger Woods, Ellen and I want to let you know that you and Amy are in our thoughts, to which Phil Mickelson replies, that's very kind, thank you. And Tiger Woods replies, hopefully they will soon find a cure, to which Mickelson replies, yeah, thanks for that, and hopefully they'll soon find a cure for your hook. You're like... And so it perhaps is more of a comment.
It's Peter.
It's Peter. That's in the past now. But then I think whatever talk of a rivalry obviously ends, Tiger's a non-force. But what you have then is the emergence of quite a respectful warmth between them. And that's been the case, I think, for a good number of years, really since 2009. So for the second half of their competitive rivalry, they've actually gotten on far better. I mean, you alluded, Joe, or you mentioned the fact the performance at the Ryder Cup, where they both blamed Hal Sutton. They didn't blame each other.
No,
they
but said, there were definitely moments where I think Phil hacked one out of bounds or hit a terrible shot, and Woods, I think, almost shook his head as if to say, Jesus, Phil.
You know, Phil had just changed his clubs, hadn't he?
I'm not sure. Was that 04?
That 04, wasn't it? Yeah.
Right. Well, but like the chemistry was also off. I mean, they both blame Hal Sutton. I mean, what they're not saying is Hal Sutton just shouldn't have put us together because we don't get on. He put them out a second time together.
And to engage in cheap psychologies, you're talking about two alpha males. Like Mickelson, in every instance, except for when he is confronted directly by Tiger Woods, he is the dominant player. He is the second best player of his generation, bar none. And yet, here he is confronted by the greatest golfer of all time. Equally, Tiger, who perhaps is well used to having players completely, like not even close to him, is dealing with this guy who has, you know, who can absolutely lay claim to being like, hang on a second, you know, yeah, sure, you're the greatest, but like, I'm not chopped cheese myself. And so that dynamic is never going to work. And it mightn't express itself in animosity, which is, I think, because the two of them have alluded to in the years since have said the media made a lot more of this rivalry than there actually was.
Right.
Now, we know this. We know this. Like, we all need a story, and that's fine. But it is worth pointing out that where they are now and where they've been for quite a number of years. And so, for instance, at the 2018 Masters, there's a great quote from Mickelson. He goes, when Tiger was going through a tough time, I wanted to do whatever I could to help out, because oftentimes that's when people aren't there. I wanted to do whatever I could during a tough time, not just the good, because I've reaped the rewards during the good times, and I'm very appreciative of what he's done for me, my family, and the game of golf.
Yeah, I remember now, that. I also remember being a little bit, I knew the relationship had improved, but I do remember being taken aback when they played a practice round together at Augusta.
That's right. They played a practice round together. But does that not say that, like, we in the media perhaps are a little, not slow to catch up, but that we just haven't been given an insight into what the true nature of the relationship is? And I hasten to add, and I'm purely speculating here, I'm sure they don't hang out that much, you know? Yes. So, you know, it's like, it is what it is. But Tiger, just to kind of finish on that point, Tiger responded when the quote was put to him. He said, when I was trying to deal with a nerve in my back and trying to come back and play, and it wasn't very good, he always texted me some really encouraging words. Now, like, if we are to believe that this was a rivalry based on real animosity, and we can find evidence where animosity was expressed, whether Mickelson criticizing Tiger's clubs, their relationship at the Ryder Cup, or I rewatched back that one. Was it in 2002 at the Tour Championship, where they're reading out, they're announcing Tiger on the tee, and they're reading out all his list, and all you have is Mickelson going, "All right, all right," and everybody just laughs, including Tiger. He's just like, and you can see he is genuinely laughing. He's not like annoyed or anything like that. So even back then, when this rivalry was meant to be really kind of at its sharpest, you know. So in terms of absolute numbers, you have this weird thing. Tiger is obviously way ahead in all levels, except for in a 1-2 head-to-head where Phil dominates 5-4, wins 5-4. As you say, the great sadness is that they never went down in a major on last Sunday and went head-to-head. But in the big tournaments, Tiger generally bested Phil. Like, he generally had the beatings of him. I can't remember, was it at the 2001 Masters where were they both leading? That's right. Yeah, at the 2001 Masters, and the final round, Woods on 12 under, he led Mickelson by one shot on 11, and he beat him with a 68, and he finished three shots ahead of Mickelson and two strokes ahead of Duval. So when it really, really told, Tiger just put the pedal down and just could get away from him. So I don't know, does that give a clearer picture of the so-called rivalry between the two best players of their generation?
Yeah. Peter, any insights into their rivalry/friendship?
Look, I think Fiona's right. I think the press, they need something to write about. They need something to create. And I think they very much created the Tiger Phil, against each other. Phil, and I've had very little dealings with the man, played with him once, really not standoffish at all. Tiger was always being, that kind of, never really wanted to mix. Phil would mix with anybody, and just the two personalities were different.
Yeah.
But I don't think there was that massive personal rivalry. It was rivalry on the golf course, and there was probably a little bit of jealousy there. On both sides, to a point, Phil early on, and then Tiger probably later on, of each other. But I really don't think there was that much to it. And we all have to, remember we're all human beings, and when somebody is suffering, you want to show that bit of support to them, because no matter what anybody says, Tiger Woods brought massive amounts of money into the game, and we all benefited from that. Trickle down to lowly me from Ireland, bringing money into the game. He brought huge money into America onto the PGA Tour, and Phil Mickelson was very much of benefit of that. His deals went up probably twofold when Tiger Woods' deals were, $10 million and initially signing with Nike. Mickelson's Callaway deal was probably worth a hell of a lot more then. I would agree with you. As I said to you, the press made more of it than there really was there.
Fellas, we are about done for this week. We will watch Tiger and Phil the match with Peyton Manning and Tom Brady, and we will reconvene next Thursday. My thanks to you, Peter Lowry, to Nathan Murphy, and to Fiona Davenport. Cheers, fellas.
Cheers,
thanks, guys.
The OTB Podcast Network.